8:14 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Board of Education spent a lot of time yesterday discussing next year's school budget. In the studio with a recap of that and other issues, I have School Board President Andrew Kaplan along with Business Administrator Todd Halber. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
So how close are we to passing a budget?
We're mighty close.
When does that happen?
I would say, well, we discussed it, actually. We discussed this timeline yesterday, and I think the legal deadline is June 20th. And it needs to be posted for 10 days prior to that, or June 22nd, is it?
June 22nd.
June 22nd. Yeah. So it needs to be posted 10 days prior to that. So by the first meeting in June, we have to have it finalized. Our target, we only have 3 to 4 outstanding items left that we've been working through for probably the last 2 months, and we hope to have those resolved in the next 2 weeks. So hopefully before the first meeting in June, but that would be our, kind of our deadline.
So is that the final budget? Because the truth and taxation hearing doesn't actually happen until August, right?
Sure. So we treat it as though it's a final budget because the school starts on July 1. But technically, it's a preliminary budget subject to the truth and taxation hearing. So we'll operate and manage ourselves, and then the truth and taxation hearing will take place mid-August.
Okay. So what are we talking about for a tax increase at this point, based on what you know?
So it's a real shot in the dark at this point because some of the pieces still being discussed have significant cost to them. General numbers are going to be somewhere around a $5 million increase. And so the cost on that for a $100,000 home is probably about $9 per $100,000. So we're in that range right now. I'm not going to shoot out a number just yet because
that's a good ballpark answer. So for $1 million home, looking at $90, something like that.
There's also an additional $2.8 million, which will be generated from levies in the school district. Does this mean that the state has increased taxes? Talk to me a little bit about that.
Sure.
The compromise of our schools now.
That's part of the story. So the basic school levy is administered by the state legislature, and that's directed to every school district to impose at the school district level. So that's the piece we're talking about is that basic levy. This year, they've added onto the basic levy a piece for pupil equity. And so that piece of money generates about $2.5 million, and those are dollars that will go to the state's accounts and then be redistributed to school districts. And the distribution formula is such that the Park City School District will not participate in that distribution. So there's a piece of money that will be raised through the basic levy and then go to the district coffers and be redistributed throughout the state. A second piece has to do with our schools now, and that is a combination of income tax money that the legislature set aside plus a property tax increase as well. And so that's running estimated about $1 million or so in that range. Again, money that will be collected through property tax, but the school district will participate in the redistribution of those funds. It's just at this point, it's not a dollar-for-dollar redistribution. So we'll send out about $1 million and then see about $450,000 come back.
Okay. So a net loss of $5.5 million.
In that range, yep.
Pretty much every time there's state action, it's a net loser for us. And this year is no different.
Yeah. So what happens if the ballot initiative to add 10 cents to the gas tax in November is approved? Because, again, that was part of the compromise with our schools now.
So that's designed to generate additional monies upwards to $700 million. That won't be realized in year one when that happens. That will be over about a 5-year period that they'll reach that level. Those dollars go into a special restricted account within the state, and the expectation is that those monies would then be available for distribution to the school districts either on a WPU basis or on a per pupil basis. That all has to be worked out through the negotiations.
So we do stand to receive
some
of that?
So that's the upward side of money coming to the district is the 10 cents. And again, the 10 cents won't come directly to the school districts. It'll go into the general fund and the transportation fund, which then relieves general fund monies in the transportation fund, and then that relieves monies going into the education. It's a trickle effect through the financing.
And then pass through at the gas tank.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that the end line is where that comes from.
Okay. Big discussion on budget items for funding for vice principal positions in our secondary schools and interventionists in the primary schools. So is that the kind of one of the unknowns or the two unknowns there?
Yeah, that's the big line item or the two big line items, however you want to look at it, that's still out there and pending. There was some more information that we wanted to see from the board side in terms of what those needs were, how many kids are going to be affected, how many kids are going to be reached, what types of, especially on the interventionist side in the elementary schools, what metrics are we going to put in place district-wide to monitor the success of those individuals, organization charts, things like that. And so I think we're, I think it's safe to say that we're moving in the direction of approving those positions pending slightly more details and some more explanation in terms of how those positions will be managed.
How many positions altogether, and what's the price tag on that?
Right now there's 13 and a half is on the budget. This would be, additional to that. Of the 13 and a half, I want to say 7 or 8 are teaching positions, and then 5 are non-teaching positions, and then these would technically be, they wouldn't be licensed teachers, but when we're talking about interventionists, they would be spending all day with students. And when we're talking about the 3 APs, those would be administrative roles where they'd be helping to deal with school discipline and, all kinds of other things to free, our principals, especially at the secondary level, up for instructional coaching.
Fair to say about $1 million then?
Yeah, in that range, somewhere between $700,000 and $1 million, depending on which level of principals we're talking about and things like that.
Additionally, as we've reported, the school board eliminated fees for courses. So again, now is part of that $5 million ballpark figure of tax increases include that million dollars for fees?
Yes, that piece is in there as well.
And it's about $700,000.
Okay.
And those are academic and mandatory fees. So it does not include the extracurricular fees, just to be clear.
So the programs like the EMT and the nursing program and the mechanics, those are
chemistry classes,
electives.
And, yes, those are electives.
Yeah. Well, no, those would be covered in terms of the fee waivers. Mm-hmm. Playing football, soccer, cheerleading would not be covered. Having an outfit for gym class would be covered. So it's the everything that's a mandatory fee for all the parents who fill out those, who write those checks every year from Ecker on. Anything that's a mandatory fee or an academic course is waived. Anything that is an extracurricular is still in place. And that's, again, something we're going to have a conversation with other community partners, including Community Foundation and the city, et cetera, about, how we want to provide equity for those activities. There's a lot of movement, including the Solomon Fund with the Community Foundation that's focused on that. And, we're going to participate along with them in a discussion to figure out what makes the most sense going forward on the rest of that.
All right. So we have an interim superintendent, David Gomez, interim curriculum director, and just announced this morning a new special ed director and interim principal at Ecker Hill has been assistant principal at Ecker Hill has been hired. So what happens if the new superintendent doesn't want to retain all of these interim positions?
So they are all interim positions. They all have end dates. The possibility exists that, all of these individuals will, gain great experience and be chosen by the new superintendent to continue in these roles or to go into other roles within administration. But everyone is going into this knowing that, their spot where they're coming from is safe and they can return to it next year or in 12 months' time whenever their special assignment is over. And so, we thank everyone who stepped up and really is going over and above, what they've been doing to really stretch themselves and do what they can for the kids of this district. And we're excited to have so many stars in our district that are willing to step up. And, Jamie Weeks, who's a high school math teacher, is stepping up to be the AP at Ecker next year, and we're thrilled about that. And the woman who we've hired, Jocelyn Knapp, to be the special ed director, is coming from Weber State University. She's a professor there, and we're excited to have her as well.
So no concern, though, that we're not letting the superintendent hire these key positions?
No, they're all the new superintendent will be able to hire all these positions.
Well, not the special ed director.
Right. The special ed director is not
assistant principal.
The assistant principal at Ecker is there because Tracy is serving as interim curriculum director. And so Sam is serving as interim principal, and so he needs an interim assistant principal, and that's kind of the domino effect that's required that. But all three of those individuals know that it's a temporary position at this point, and it could develop into a permanent position, but that would be at the decision of the new superintendent.
So we'll have two assistant principals at Ecker then?
That depends on...
This morning's hire sounded like it was a full-time position.
No, that position is for a year, while Tracy is at the district office and Sam is the acting principal at Ecker. So Jamie Weeks' position will be, along those same lines. And but the great news is that we have the talent here at the district that, we're able to pull these individuals in and have them step into leadership roles. And it's a great thing to see, to have, such a strong roster of talent.
Why did the board think an interim superintendent was needed?
Well, an interim superintendent was definitely needed regardless of timing because Dr. Conley's job she has a new job that she's accepted, and her end date was in June. There's a lot of functions that take place over the summer that require a superintendent's involvement, whether those are discussions around professional development, curriculum. There's a lot of things that happen administrative-wise over the summer, and she was not going to be here for that regardless. So it was really an issue of timing. I think we all were hoping that, when she first announced her resignation, that she would be here throughout the summer. I think once she accepted that new position, that changed the timeline. And then given the fact that the superintendent who she was replacing in Mesa was leaving in May, that upped the time frame even more. And so we were always going to have to select an interim. It was probably just going to be in June as opposed to in April. So we were about 6 weeks early.
Yeah. So taxpayers are paying for Superintendent Conley's contract through the end of June. I mean, what are we getting for it? I mean, if she's not here.
Well, she's helping in transition. She is, providing, updates on all of the things that she was, that were ongoing projects, whether that was a safety initiative or, personnel evaluations of the principals, school evaluations, which is one of the responsibilities that kind of kicks in around this time of year. So all of those things she's continuing to help us with. We were going to have her help us regardless, over the summer as we transition to a new super. And in some ways, this helps us in that, Dave Gomez is going to have a lot more knowledge to give, and he's staying in the district. So he'll be there on a day-to-day basis when the new super starts.
Yeah. So, Todd, I mean, what's it costing us then basically to have two superintendents on the payroll?
Yep. That it's for just a couple of months, though. So it's not like we're trying to carry a full load for a full year. It's just a 2 month period.
And then the new superintendent would start July 1 with a new budget year. Is that the plan?
That would be the hope. It also depends on where they are and what their notice period is from leaving their current district. And, our goal is to have them there by the start of school, obviously. But it could be July 1, it could be August 1, it could be September 1. We don't, we can't foresee that. And that's, again, one of the reasons why we're going to have that interim anyways.
As I recall, the communications director was hired to support Ember Conley. Does that position stay with next year's budget since Ember's leaving? I guess that's your decision.
Yeah, that position is staying.
Yeah. Let me see. Safety update. Vestibules, entryways are going to be done soon in all of the schools?
Well, that's what we're working through. I think, the latest update we've had is that the bulk of the construction will take place over the summer and everything will be in place for the new year. But that's what we're trying to pin down. And we're going to have updates every 2 weeks at every board meeting to go over that. We're working on the on the fencing RFP right now. We have the input from our community neighbors, especially at Parley's and Trailside, and so we're working through that. And you know, the vestibules, there's still work to be done. You know, I think with the latest update, there were some HVAC and some plumbing things that needed to happen. And I mean, there's, it's building in Park City. It just kind of drags on. So we're, we're still targeting the beginning of the school year. And every 2 weeks, we'll have an update for you on how that's going. I think, everyone in our buildings cares, our parents care. We have vestibules that are half completed, which, is kind of contra to what our goal is, which is to make the facilities more secure. And so we appreciate that both parents and staff members are bearing with us through this. And, the goal is that at the completion of this, we'll be, much more secure in our campuses and the kids will be safer.
So has the controversy at some of those elementary schools then been worked out with regard to the fencing?
Well, I mean,
you said you're still working on some design issues.
We're working on the design issues, and I think so. I mean, in the ones that I've been involved in, at Parley's and Trailside, I think it's very clear what the neighbors want, and we're trying to do our best to give it to them. It's, it's just going through the final, the bid process, as well as one last look at it from a security perspective. But I think we're close to a compromise on, in both of those schools with our neighbors. And, I think everyone acknowledges that, unfortunately, as this year has gone on, that there's been more and more safety issues at schools across the country, and everyone wants the kids to be safe. So the neighbors are being very supportive and cooperative and working with us. And now it's just an issue of, finalizing the plans with them, getting the parts ordered and installed.
Yeah. So are they willing to kind of pay the difference from what the school board wanted with black chain link to maybe the wood?
We're still working through that. And again, we're not going to have the final numbers until we get through the bid processes on the materials. But, we'll cross that bridge when we get there. I think the most important thing is that the kids are safe and secure. And if it costs the schools a bit more money, or, if the HOAs of the neighborhoods pitch in some, we'll work out those details. But I think everyone has a shared interest in keeping the children safe and having it look as nice as possible. So given that's the case, I'm not super concerned at this point that we won't get to an agreement.
This weekend, the school board's scheduled to do the interviews with the superintendent. How many are you going to be talking with?
We'll see. It'll be five or six finalists. The interviews will be all day Saturday, so it's going to be a pretty long day. But we're excited. People are coming in from all over the country, and we're excited about the slate of candidates we have. We have 12 community and staff members who are going to be joining in the interview process, and they're all extremely excited as well. They're very highly qualified. We have a good professional background from the community members, and diversity in terms of professional experience on the district side. Again, we have some quality people who will be there, and who have obviously a great vested interest in seeing who the new super is. So we're all looking forward to it and can't wait.
Did the district agree to pay for their travel and lodging while they're here?
Yeah, we are participating in that. We were able to secure very, very, very good rates at the Montage in Deer Valley. They were very generous with us in terms of giving us a great price, and which is going to be cheaper than the rack rate at anywhere else in town. So thank you to the Montage for that contribution, and I think they're all looking forward to being here.
The plan is then to narrow it down to what, two or three?
Yeah, I think we're open to how the process goes on Saturday. I think we're all going to go over strengths and weaknesses of each candidate, and we could come out of this process with three finalists. We could come out of the process with one. And I think we all have an open mind, and we'll see how the community and staff groups think and how the board thinks.
Yeah. So at what point does the committee leave this process?
So they're going to start on Friday with an orientation, Friday evening from 5 to 7, and then they will participate in the interviews and then do a wrap up afterwards, and then that will be their involvement. So screening the candidates, looking for positives, negatives, giving recommendations based on that, and then the board will take all that feedback in along with our consultant and narrow down the finalist list.
All right, wanted to. In particular, I mean, what are you looking for, Andrew? I mean, do you have you kind of top three qualities of a superintendent that you're looking for?
Sure. I think, you know, the biggest thing is that we continue with the success that we've had in our district. And we want someone who's a strong leader who, you know, both staff and community look up to, someone who has leadership experience in this type of role in a demanding community, and someone who's a manager of people who can take the stars that we have at our district, whether those are teaching stars or administrative stars, and give them a path, you know, to continue to rise. And so, you know, we were fortunate to have a good superintendent for 5 years. We have a very highly functioning district, and we're looking for someone to take it to, you know, to that next level. So, you know, and the consensus from the community and the surveys that we had, you know, we hear things like good communicator, strong leader, you know, strong in personnel. It's all the same themes, interestingly enough, from whether it was the questions were asked to staff or administration or, you know, teachers or community members or, you know, whoever was asked, a lot of the same things, you know, came to the forefront. So
real quick, wanted to ask you about the there was going to be a discussion with regard to the student on the board, a potential policy change there. What happened there?
Yeah, so the policy, I don't know, it's what, almost 20 years old, maybe longer. And it's the last time it was revised was 5 years ago. Traditionally, the student on the board is a junior. This year, the nomination from the high school is a senior. And so we had a discussion around whether or not to make an exception to the policy. And then that brought up some further discussion around how we get student voice more involved in the process of the board. And I think we need to refocus a little bit on that. Member J.J. Ehlers has kind of championed that. She went to the NSBA conference, and that's a movement that's happening nationwide in terms of getting students more involved in the decisions that boards are making. And so I think as a unit, we're going to look to the student government and the high school especially and the leaders there to help us kind of rework that policy and rework the participation from students in terms of how they're giving, you know, feedback and advice to the board.
So did you approve that exemption then? So the senior
yes,
will serve?
And
then
did.
Real quick, what about the exemption to the policy then for the music students?
Yeah, so that is a pretty exciting trip that these guys are going on. They're going to Normandy, I believe, over the summer. And the policy states that students have to be in ninth grade to travel internationally. The issue is there were a handful of eighth graders who were rising into the ninth grade, and they miss, you know, they're technically ninth graders 5 days later than the trip was. So the band teachers came to us and said, hey, can we get an exception to policy 9045 to allow these kids to participate in what's essentially a once in a lifetime trip to participate in a event like that. And the board looked at it, and we spoke to risk management as well. And because this is an exception, it's not a new precedent, we approved it.
Okay. Andrew, Todd, anything else you wanted to mention real quick?
Thanks for the time this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Council meeting and work session tomorrow starting at 3:30 in the studio. To preview that agenda, I have City Manager Diane Foster along with Special Events Manager Jenny Dearson. Good morning.
Good morning. And I think we're going to need about 2 hours to talk about it because there are 26 items on the agenda. I think we've set a new record, and we even had some items move off the agenda. So it's a spring and quiet season for everyone except City Council.
400 pages was the packet. Yeah. So
if you use the new Granicus software, which you can download for free, it doesn't look, you can't tell how long it is.
budget presentation, basically, it'll be your recommended budget. And I'll get the budget team on air to be a little bit more specific here. But in terms of tax increases, I mean, are we talking about a tax increase? And how can we not talk about a tax increase after bonding for Bonanza Flat?
Absolutely not a tax increase. The bonding for Bonanza Flat was a voter-approved bond, and the city had already, about $25 million, and the city had already identified the funding sources for the balance of that. So that one's covered. And one of the highlights of this particular budget is looking for things in the capital budget that we can eliminate, as you know, City Council, specifically to help reduce the price of the Treasure Hill bond. As you know, City Council has already taken the Brewpub Plaza off the table. Another one that we've already, as staff, we've already said we can't do this is the public utilities building. There was a placeholder for that of about $4.5 million. The whole project was going to be about $20 million. And we've just said we're not going to do that. Clint McAfee has been leading the charge along with Blake Fonsback to identify other facilities. And one of the benefits of Bonanza Flats that isn't well publicized, but obviously council had to approve it in a public meeting, was that we also acquired part of the Mine Bench property. And it is in super rough shape. However, that's great use of taxpayer dollars to take an existing building and do interior renovations. And also, it's important for us to be able to keep public utilities in town so that we're not shipping them out of town and increasing our carbon footprint by having, public works folks come in from the outskirts.
So just in addition to those two, then, the brew pub and the public utilities, anything else that's on the chopping block?
There are other things that staff has identified. You know, it's also really important, while Treasure Hill is clearly the top on the agenda, it's also City Council has critical priorities. So what you don't want to do in these situations is, number one, you want to be careful not to say we're going to gut the streets fund, which some communities do, because it will cost you more later. So the other piece is affordable housing. We're recommending City Council not touch that fund. There are, I think, currently five projects going on right now for housing, and those are all super important.
Okay. Jenny, let's move to you. Council spent about an hour in work session discussing special events and levels of service. What are you hoping for out of this discussion?
You know, this is a council-requested work session, so they asked that we come back and have a check-in on the balance of the event calendar and where we are and what we have done really over the last 3 years. So from creating SEAC to making code changes to increasing or changing the fee reduction policy and further mitigating events, reducing impacts on residents, are things that we have done, but really looking at the next steps and where events are headed, hoping to get direction tomorrow just on the role of events and the overall balance of the calendar. I think a big thing is also the level of service being provided at events, and what that really means is the mitigation. And if we're happy with that level of service and the mitigation that's going on, the next question is who should be paying for that mitigation? And does the city have a role in doing that, or should some of those costs be pushed back onto the event applicants? Again, this is really a check-in. We have a number of recommendations. There's things such as creating a new quarterly application deadline to streamline the approval and denial process, potentially limiting approvals in shoulder seasons unless it's a compelling community event, and then creating blackout times in the peak season. And once we get direction on some of those recommendations, we will be returning for either further work session or further council and public hearings about those next steps.
Okay. Later on in the agenda, though, we're going to be discussing or at least taking public input with regard to the application. Is there an application from yep. Park City Institute?
Yes, we received that application on Friday.
Okay, so the clock is ticking, but the council isn't going to make a determination on this yet?
So this is a preliminary discussion, and I think the big thing here is public input. And so we will be discussing the potential for the venue location at Quinn's. The Gilmore Trust did give permission for a one-year agreement at that location. And then looking at proposed dates of that event, staff does have some preliminary concerns with overall event threshold and some potential conflicts, and we will hopefully get direction on that moving forward. Current estimate of fee reduction, which could go higher or could be less depending on the amount of dates and mitigation, right now is at about $36,000 for that event, and so just a little direction on those possible fees as well.
Yeah. The staff report notes that the event would cause impacts to transportation, environmental sustainability, and increased cost to the city. How different is that as opposed to, there's just as much traffic going up to Deer Valley?
I think the difference up at Deer Valley is that venue is built for concerts. So the Snow Park Amphitheater has that infrastructure. They have a stage. They have a lot of parking, and it's on an existing transit route. The Quinn's location, while it is viable potential location, it does propose some logistic challenges, whether it's transit and parking or, where we place the stage. And so staff does need time to work through those logistics. We are not at a point where we can recommend the approval, and Park City Institute and Big Stars Bright Nights concert series will be required to mitigate sufficiently those impacts that the event may cause, and we'll work with them on developing those plans.
Yeah, can't you just put everybody at Richardson Flat and shuttle them over?
That is a potential possibility, looking at those costs to run transit. And, you know, I think another big thing is being on 248 and having the hospital out there, making sure we can maintain those access points and access to all the surrounding businesses. So we do have some work to do, and it is a preliminary discussion. And again, public input is encouraged at the meeting as well.
I do want to add, though, that staff, you know, if you would see the number of hours that Jenny here and Jonathan Weidenhammer have put into this, it's incredible. And conceptually, staff is supportive. Now, that's at the high level. Then staff needs to drill down into the details and say, how do we make sure that this doesn't have negative consequences for the community? So how do we help this event be the best it can be? I think you'll see City Council give a strong message this week. So while it's not final action, I think folks will know. And I believe in general that that City Council is conceptually supportive of this within the parameters of there are some evenings where there are some direct conflicts that, and those are the ones we're going to discuss. But I think the idea that this is a community partner who is hugely valued, and no one should mistake discussion of details with a non-support. So we very much support this organization, and we're committed to doing the best we can for the community.
Yeah. Now, should the city look at this request differently from as a nonprofit as it would from a for-profit venture?
You know, I think there's so many of the events, you know, are organized by nonprofits in Park City. About 95% of our events are organized by local nonprofits. You know, in the end, it is about mitigating impacts. And I think what Diane said is there is no question that we value Park City Institute, has a very compelling connection to our community, arts and culture, and with all of the educational programs it does. But then as we're looking at the event calendar and mitigating impacts and creating a balance, all of those things are important to balance with the potential impacts and making sure that we are doing our job and ensuring public safety and ensuring smooth flow of traffic and all of those things.
Which makes it the hardest discussion to have, right? If these were all for-profit events, it'd be really easy for City Council to just say, hey, let's prioritize them and then let's take the bottom ones and cut them off. The reality is you're talking about impacting nonprofits, and when 95% of our special events have a nexus with a nonprofit, that is an extremely difficult situation for a city council. So they'll be talking, one of the important things they'll be talking about in this work session is what tools do they have? Do they want to cap events? I met a city manager in Duluth, Georgia, who in their town, they have a rule that after 3 years, no fees are waived. It doesn't matter if it's a nonprofit or for-profit. That's just the rule that they have, and that limits events. So we're going to look at all the tools we have, and council's going to have a discussion.
So these 10 concerts that would normally be at Deer Valley, does Deer Valley then add 10 concerts to its?
They are currently not planning on adding 10 additional concerts. They've had the Deer Valley Music Festival, which is hosted by the Utah Symphony, and then, of course, the Wednesday night concerts. So we do anticipate receiving an application for an additional concert series with potentially up to six concerts at that venue in the upcoming weeks, but we have not received confirmation of that yet.
Okay. I wanted to move back also in work session an update on food trucks. Legislation apparently changed code, reducing municipalities' ability to regulate food trucks. This goes into effect later this month. So what does that mean for Park City now? I mean, you're going to have to allow them because the feeling in the past has been it's not really fair for a food truck to come in, set up shop when we've got tax, business owners paying big property taxes for the brick and mortar.
I believe that is still the sentiment of I don't want to speak for City Council, but that's what we've heard from them in the past. It's also the sentiment of staff. That being said, state law changes, so we respond to it. The legislation goes into effect on May 8th. We'll be working with the Restaurant Association as well as the Historic Park City Alliance and the Lodging Association and the resorts we want to be within state law, and we want to continue to regulate food trucks. So, for example, City Council has broad authority about food trucks on public property. There's also the ability to regulate them during special events. So we can actually allow them during, like, if, for example, the Silly Market brings them in. The timeline for this is really important. What we're doing right now is looking, we've got, this will now be considered a pending ordinance, so we'll be in compliance with state law. However, this has a timeline. This is really just the start. This has a timeline that goes through August. And what will happen in that timeline is on May 5th, we'll issue the public notice of the pending ordinance, and it'll be on the Planning Commission agenda for May 23rd. We really need Planning Commission to take a look at this and give us feedback on it. We also will be limiting franchises as well. And also, they are appropriate in certain places. If you look out at the movie studio, it's not really competing with anything out there. That seems like an appropriate place. There are other places such that staff is looking at where there's light industrial, where there, it might be appropriate to have food trucks.
Okay. Another item on the agenda with a final fee adjustment of almost $10,400 for the Prospector Property Owners Association. Staff's recommended that the council deny this, and I am trying to figure out why you would.
This is
it's money owed, right?
It's actually, it would be fee waivers for a project that normally they would have to pay those for. While staff is recommending a denial, staff is bringing this to City Council instead of just denying it, because there are some reasons why City Council, and they have the authority, may want to waive it. Staff's perspective is simply that this does not, they do not meet the definition of a charitable organization, even though they're technically a nonprofit. And this is, they've been an important partner. We've got a lot of things that'll be happening there over the next few years. So while staff does have a negative recommendation, there's also a little bit of a, however, if City Council wants to weigh this, they are within their authority.
Okay. I also wanted to bring up real quick that staff had scheduled individual appointments earlier this week with the current tenants of the Prospector Square condominiums that the city bought. Apparently no promises made, but tell what was the purpose of those? I mean, we've got some residents who are very concerned that they're going to lose their homes so that the city can make way for bus drivers there.
Sure. And let's be clear, if a private developer bought those, and right, the city bought those specifically to keep them in the affordable pool, those people would have been out a month ago. They would have been gone. They would have not, nobody would have met with them. Nobody would have talked to them about a transition schedule or how the city can help find them. That developer who bought those would have never sat down and met with them and said, how can we help you move? So that's what the city is doing. Number one, it's really important in some of the unoccupied units, and there are some that are unoccupied, as well as in some of the occupied units, there are bug issues, right? I actually can't even repeat it because it gives me the creeps. But that was the city's first priority, is get in there and deal with the bug issue. Number two, very much the city cares about people. And so being able to sit down with them individually and saying, what's your situation? Where are you working? What's your plan? And how can we help you? And so City Council has not made a decision yet on timing or if and when. I do expect at some point people will have to move. We are working with them and hope to find them alternative plans.
Yeah. So, I mean, if they're working within the city limits, I mean, why does a bus driver take precedent over, you know, a dishwasher?
There are lots of folks in there who are not working within city limits. I know one of the residents works at Home Depot and has for many years. And and many of these people would not qualify for affordable housing, right? These are Talisker deed restriction, but they would not necessarily fall within the city's guidelines for affordable housing. So those are all, there are lots of discussions underway, and I haven't been sitting in those meetings, but I do know it's been a priority for staff.
Okay. And then real quick, the farmers market, this is just a temporary change?
Yep, this is a one-year change as far as I currently understand due to construction at the canyon. So Park City Farmers Market has been held out there for many years. And so Vail has agreed to move that event to Park City Base. So it is on 17 Wednesdays throughout the summer, and it provides a great opportunity for local farmers and our community to go to that venue.
Okay. So is it just a one-year deal, or does it – well, it, I mean, construction is gangbusters out at Canyons Village.
So as of now, as per the property permission received, it is 1 year, and we'll see what happens after this year.
Okay. Anything else you guys need to mention?
I do just want to mention really quick, Alfred asked me to remind everyone that construction on 224 starts on Monday. So that is from Bear Hollow to Kearns. And then also another reminder, it is bike month, so we'll see everyone on their bikes.
Okay. Jenny, Diane, thank you.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:54. 8:55, good morning. Well, this year's Young Riders Bike Swap will be held May 12th and 13th in the studio with details. Young Riders Executive Director Heinrich Dieters, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's see. Why don't you just kind of basically give us the details? You're collecting gear now at Jan's in White Pine?
Yeah, why don't I start at youngriders.com is where you can find all the information just in case you miss, because there's quite a bit involved in it. We have a bike swap, our annual bike swap. I think this is my 14th or 15th year, and it's been going on well before that. But so we've been doing it for a long time. The swap takes place this Mother's Day weekend, which is May 12th and 13th, as you noted. May 12th, it's from 8 to 5 p.m., and that's where we sell a majority of our bikes. It's very, very busy in the morning, so to get the best price, it's good to show up at that time. And then on the 13th, we do it from 11 to 3 p.m. And just a little shout out, thanks to Mark Fisher and Mike Sweeney. They always help us with that venue over there. It's been a great opportunity for us. But say you want to sell your bike. The opportunities right now are to drop the bikes off at Jan's or White Pine, both sponsors of the swap, and they'll help you check it in, etc. And then that will get into the swap. The other opportunities that you have are on Thursday, May 10th from 3 to 7 p.m. and Friday, May 11th, 12 to 8. We get a lot of bikes there, and those drop-off points are right there at the yard. So you go into the back behind the blind dog, and the garage is up, and we'll be sitting right there helping you. To that point, whether you drop off at the bikes at the bike shops or there at the yard, we have people that will help you price the bikes. We also ask people to bring bikes in good working condition. And we would even encourage people, like, take a little bit of time and go to Jan's White Pine and get maybe a tune-up, put new tires on it. It's not unknown that people will come in and they're looking at a bike and it has a flat tire and they just put it back in the rack. So it might be a great bike, but just because it has a flat tire, it doesn't get looked at for a while. So good opportunity on that. And then one more thing I wanted to cover is this will be our third year for doing online check-in. So this is an opportunity if you've participated in a swap. It takes a little bit of time to actually check your bike in, but you can do that at home. So if you just go again to youngriders.com and you'll scroll, actually it's at the top, it says bike swap, click on that. And then a little bit further down, you'll see check-in, online check-in. And you can do that at your home. You can take a picture of your bike, etc. And then when you bring it to the bike shop or to the yard, we just print off your tickets right there and just put them on. You're in and out. It's super fast. It's like the what's the ski lift line that you just go through or whatever. I can't remember what
it is.
Fast
tracks.
Fast tracks, exactly. So that's our personal Young Riders fast track. So that's about it.
Well, in addition to bikes, besides bikes, what else do you accept?
So we do accept that we've gotten more and more apparel over the years. We get a lot of helmets. A lot of the reps will bring in stuff from their last year's inventory. So it's not only used things. You'll see actually a lot of new items that are there. Shoes. We definitely go through kids strollers and things like that. Those are, you know, very popular. And then bike racks, etc. So really anything associated with bicycles.
Okay. You do take a percentage of all sales. What's that at?
We do. We take 20%. Thanks for asking that. So we take 20% of the sales. But again, we try to work with people and say, you know, look, here's what you'll probably be able to price your bike at. And this is the amount that'll go to actually Young Riders.
All right. And then how much does it raise for you guys?
It always depends. We never know. It's I think the highest we've gotten is about $10,000. And sometimes we only make, say, $4,000. And so, you know, the Young Riders program has been set up primarily that our costs are pretty much covered through the participation of kids doing the camp. Many of our other costs are very, very low. So we take this money and it's always just sort of a nice to have. And we use it for our scholarships. And a few other items. We do a Latino camp that we do that, and we help, you know, fix the bikes, et cetera, along with Park City Foundation. And then a lot of times we'll take some of the money and we'll put it just towards our T-shirts. So if you sign up and you're the first, Julie, my wife's going to kill me, I think it's the first 300 or something like that that register, we give just a free T-shirt or riding shirt to the kids, and we use that for some of the money. So, you know, just we've always looked at this as this just a great opportunity for the community to come and get together and celebrate spring.
Okay, Heinrich, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.